Some of you may not know it, but Ianthe is a teacher of teachers. She was a principal of a teacher's training college,
or vice principal. No, she was deputy principal.
Deputy. Yeah, but even so, you see, she's a significant person in the world of teaching. And in my theosophical career as a talker, I seem to have been doing it for a long number of years, I have learned quite a lot from Ianthe. I have been taught by her. And one of the things she has taught me is that when you have been through a considerable amount of material in putting it out, you give the students time to assimilate it. And the beginning of that process is a review of what you have said. And that's what this program's about, this session this morning is about. I have given some information concerning man from a number of points of view, and going through these lectures, I want to pick out some of the highlights, but just to refresh your minds, the first talk was an introductory one, wherein, you remember, I said that by 1975, we in the Theosophical Society were hoping for the advent of another teacher. And so far as anybody knows, as I know of, such an one hasn't put in an appearance in person, and certainly not in the Theosophical Society. But it does seem that there are these movements, which I have repeatedly referred to, wherein people are realizing the significance of the individual, and individuals of like mind are getting together to form these networks. And in my last talk, you will remember that I think that in the Theosophical Society, we have the nucleus of such a worldwide network in which all of us can work and make our contribution. Then, without going into more detail of the lecture, you remember I talked about the holographic universe and the implicate and explicate model, with spirit, so to speak, shining through all of manifestation in everything that there is. Everything that there is an expression of some spiritual, some cosmic spiritual quality. Then we said that man, in particular, was a window to this shining light, and that through him, as he progresses, so more and more of this divine light could shine. We referred to him as the microcosm of the macrocosm, a miniature copy of the cosmos itself. I don't want to go into too much detail on this. Then I mentioned the rule, which has certainly helped me in trying to understand the doctrine, as given in the secret doctrine, that of as above, so below. And that, I wish I could repeat it, that axiom, that hermetic axiom, says a lot else. Perhaps you can you recite it, Adam?
Not in its entirety, no.
It's a very good thing. I wish I'd looked it up so that I could read it to you.
In that little thing, Madame Blavatsky, on how to study theosophy,
yes, it is.
Which is republished at the end of Foundations, it is all there, and it is the hermetic axiom, as the within, so the without. And then she says there is no within and no without, because all are one.
Yes, that's right. And he that something it is one.
He that worketh it.
He that worketh it is one. Now, the significance of that, as far as I'm concerned, is that I'm not a student of Adam's quality, in that my brains don't comprehend the details so well of the process. But in those times when I have got immersed in the detail, such as the hierarchical structure of cosmos and what each of the hierarchies do, if you apply this as above, so below rule to yourself, you find over a period of time that you begin to have a different concept of your own being. You are reflecting in yourself the functions, so to speak, of these cosmic hierarchies. You are really a miniature reflection of them and can sense, so to speak, their big scale activity closely related to your small scale activity. You can get a vision in those terms of the cosmic structure and the cosmic process. And this really can happen. You remember I was saying some complimentary words about Adams, the amount of work that he had done. And he said that it hadn't been a labor, it had been a joy, or had been something which he wanted to do. I can go a little further than that and say that at times, and this is literally true, one is transported with joy at the insights that come when you begin to see what this process is about. It's so strong you can hardly contain it. It really is. Now, this indicates to me something of the rightness of this study that couldn't happen if it were not so. And then I've made a point about the evolutionary journey. Now, we've seen a number of the aspects of the evolutionary journey in the big scale, and I related some of them in my last talk to man's progress as an individual and what he can do about it. Now he has become responsible for his own progress since the advent of mind. We are responsible for our own future. But in that talk, I also added something, and this was at the request of Ianthe, to do with the key thoughts of theosophy. And they're more than that. Some of these things, I intend to read you these because they're worth a recap. They are unique to theosophy. You will not find them anywhere else. They may be referred to. They may be obscurely mentioned in many a classical writing, many an ancient scripture, and so on. But they are not put explicitly. They are not put in plain language. They are not put together such that they relate to one another and make a composite whole. And I'll just go through these quickly again. Unity, the idea of the one being manifest throughout cosmos. Everything in cosmos is in and of that one. There is nothing else. And from that stems, when you start in the secret doctrine at the beginning, what I call the theosophical metaphysics. This admittedly is very difficult, but it takes time for the ordinary mind to assimilate the meaning of the terms and then see their significance. It can and was for me for many years an arid exercise. It didn't come alive, it wasn't meaningful to me at all. It was explanations of the origins of cosmos in terms which I felt could never be understood. Well, as time has gone by, those terms have become very meaningful to me. Very meaningful. All the first part of the secret doctrine, including the three fundamental propositions, are very meaningful, very significant, pregnant, so to speak, with content that is very relevant to the study. But it takes time. Our minds have got to be conditioned to this order of thinking. Then, as a sort of corollary to the oneness, there is the postulate that cosmos is a living whole, a living. Everything in it is an expression of that one life, and everything in it is living. There is no such thing as dead matter. Even the inorganic matter of the chemists is in its base, far enough deep down in its constitution, is living stuff. Its energy is that of life. These are not in order. Then the next thing is the enormous evolution, the enormous sort of genesis and evolutionary process in terms of the globes. Nowhere else will you find that. It is reflected in some of the very early Kabbalistic writings. And it's very interesting in this connection. I don't know whether Ianthi discovered this, but in the office of the General Secretary in London, there's a little bookcase by the door that goes into the General Secretary's secretary's office, a leather-bound volume written, handwritten, on sort of parchment stuff. It's a Zenyuter, I think the word is, a Kabbalistic book, and the diagrams that HPB uses in the Secret Doctrine for the Chains of Globes are in that book. It's handwritten and in Latin. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Did you know that?
Handwritten.
I think it's handwritten. It's not printed.
Oh.
I think so.
Well, I know the books, but I haven't read the books.
Well, there it is. My impression at this time is that if it's printed, it's on very old yellow paper, and the ink is going a bit brown, and it certainly is old. It must be 300-400 years old. Anyway, it's interesting to know that those diagrams are in that book. So we can't claim to be the originators of these ideas of rounds and races. But when the system is put together, as we've heard Adam put it together, not particularly in relation to man, but those of us who were at the school last year and heard his talks on the evolution of the globes and so on, we'll see what a splendid, comprehensive system that is. Now, as far as I know, that is not given anywhere else but in our literature. The origins of cosmos are, of course, part of the tale. Then there's another significant part to our teaching, is that of the elements of being. The elements in terms of what in the West we call the philosopher's elements: earth, water, air, fire, and one other partially manifest now, ether, a second differentiation of akasha, which is the highest synthetic element. And two more to come in the two later rounds. But these elements are of significance particularly because they relate to our senses and the tattvas and so on, the states of matter. Now this is a kind of chemical framework, so to speak, of cosmos, because all the scientific elements, of which there are now over 100 known, derive by differentiation and combination from those initial four states of matter. As these are inner states of matter, but they reflect into the physical world, and as I say, by differentiation and combination, they produce the materials of the physical world that we now know of. So they're very significant. Now again, the Kabbalists knew of these elements, but they did not spell out what they meant and how they relate to the elements of science. The constitution of man. Nowhere else is there this sevenfold classification. In the Hindu scriptures there's a fivefold one, but you notice how necessary it is that directly corresponds in many respects to the sevenfold nature of cosmos. And if you try to work with a different constitution of man, your correspondences don't fit. And the correspondence series in the Secret Doctrine is really quite amazing. The number of aspects that there are to this is wonderful. And again, it is the insights into the way these things fit so nicely together that when you see them, provoke this joy-making thing inside you. It's real thighs of slapping glee when you come across something which has been obscure and then suddenly you see. And it's wonderful. You can't explain this to anybody else, by the way. It comes over dead if you try to tell someone else. The perception must have arisen from within themselves. The next unique thing is absolutely unique to Theosophy is this description of the after-death states and the reincarnation process. Many people have made an attempt at this. There are many accounts from the spiritualists. There are many attempts, well, not many, there's the Eliphas Levi attempts in the Kabbalistic literature, some of which checks with ours and some doesn't. But there is nowhere such a comprehensive and detailed explanation of what happens to us after death as in our literature. And I didn't bring my little book, but our masters said that they had to learn this process at first hand for themselves. Not by dying, but during the process of their initiation. They experience these states about which they write. They are not purveying second-hand information. And they are living men. They are not spooks. Most of the other information we get from the other side, we haven't dealt with psychism and so on in these talks, come from people on the other side. And the spiritualists say, how then can we deny it? They're there, they know what they're talking about. Well, the masters say, who's doing the talking? And then you have seen how it is that splendidly do the hierarchies fit into the whole scheme, or the idea of hierarchies. The whole business is a hierarchy of life at various stages of development. That is what cosmos is. You and I are of that nature and inseparable from it. So that doctrine of hierarchies, again, is not by any means a new one, but as it's spelt out in our literature and as it is related to all the other details of the construction and processes of nature, it is quite unique. Nowhere else would you find that. And then, as I've just indicated, when you use the information that we now have concerning the constitution of man and the nature of the elements and so on, which incidentally themselves are living things, and their spirit, or soul if you like, are the elementals, without which there could be no happening in nature. The elementals stand behind every phenomenal thing, that event in nature. Everything. They're not little fairies and little gnomes dancing about in your garden. That idea came about much later. They do relate to the philosophers, salamanders and whatever else the four things were, undines and sprites. But those were names given to classes of them. They are the animating or animated centers of force operating through all nature. Well, there's a pretty considerable list of the areas in which the Theosophical teaching is unique. No other place will you find that. Now, yesterday we had a discussion, we being A, the Executive Committee, and B, the
directors
and the directorate, about the future of this school. Now, we'll be able, I suppose, to go on uttering, that is we, I don't know who we may be, whoever the teachers are, the basic theosophical truths till the cows come home, year after year. And some of you may attend from year after year. Well, how will your knowledge grow? By listening repeatedly to the same things. It may be that they'll get a bit richer. But it seems to me that we should have an introduction to how this precious knowledge of ours relates to what is going on in the world in terms of scientific research, in terms of psychological research, in terms of the people that do social work and so on, and learn about the community behaviour of humanity. All these things are relevant and relate to our closely. Our teachings relate to them directly, but the people working in these fields in the world have no knowledge of the inner workings of nature. They don't have that. Now, this is the key to understanding in their own particular branch, and it's the key to understanding how one branch of knowledge relates to the other, so that they don't study, so to speak, the whole business in isolation, as they tend now to do. Marilyn Ferguson, who wrote the book, indicates that scientists are discovering that this interdisciplinary communication is just beginning to occur. The biologists are taking notice of what the physicists say, and the artists and the religionists are taking notice of what the scientists say. The thing is beginning to synthesize. The holistic, using the word holistic in another sense now, is beginning to come into human affairs. Well, I don't think I need spend time on lecture two again. I've explained now the importance of the sevenfold constitution of man, because it reflects the sevenfold constitution of cosmos and all the intricate, and they're very intricate, scales of correspondence that there is between man's being and that of nature. Then in number three, we dealt with the hierarchical structure of man. We said that cosmos, for instance, was composed of countless lives, and so is man at the various levels of his being. And a little bit about man's origins, which Adam has so admirably dealt with during his lectures so far. There is no absolute beginning to anything, you will remember. Everything stems from and is the result of causes set going in the past. As far as I can discover, and I think this is the general view, there never was an absolute beginning to anything. The process is really everlasting. Everything in man, as we have said, has its counterpart in cosmos. He is built up of Jahn Johannic essences. We're learning now in some detail as to what this means in terms of his body, from the models brought over by the lunar petries, and all the other principles of man, all the other middle principles of man come to him from other hierarchies of being. And then finally he is endowed with mind. There was one thing I intended to read to you, and I hope it doesn't steal any of Adam's thunder, but there's a beautiful stanza which explains this process. SD 205. We won't have time to explain it, but I think the meaning is fairly obvious. The breath, SD 205, it stands, well, I haven't made a note of it.
17.
No, it's Shloka 17. Shloka 17 in vol 2, so it doesn't matter what the stanza is.
Stanza 4.
Do you want to quote this?
No, you go ahead.
The breath. That is the human monad. Now we've got an idea of what this human monad is, needed a form. The fathers gave it, the Petries gave it. The breath needed a gross body. The earth molded it. The breath needed the spirit of life, prana, jiva. The solar lars, you remember those, the solar angels, breathed it into his form. and the breath needed a mirror of its body, form, the astral shadow. We gave it our own, said the jnanis. The breath needed a vehicle of desires, a kama rupa. It has it, said the drainer of waters. I don't know quite what the drainers of waters are, perhaps Adam will tell us. Suchi it's described as, the fire of passion and animal instinct. Now, the breath needs a mind to embrace the universe. Isn't that a lovely expression? We can't give it that. Can't give that, said the fathers. I never had it, said the spirit of the earth. The form would be consumed were I to give it mine, said the great fire, the great solar fire, the life, the jiva principle. Man remained an empty, senseless buta, empty shell. And thus have the boneless given life to those who became later men with bones in the third race. Now, that is a story up to a point, you see, and then come the Agnishvata Pitris, all those Kumaras and so on, that have those various names and gave man life, and he then became man as we know him. And there is another stanza, which I can't immediately turn up, about the middle principles of man, which are interesting. But there it is. I'm only reviewing the things we've said. Then we had a look at the methods of reproduction, which are reflected still into the forming of a man. And then you remember I made the quite important statement that karma overrides heredity. That our personal characteristics brought over from another life by way of the skandhas override the inherited characteristics. Incidentally, the secret doctrine does not skim over these things as I am doing now. It goes into the mechanism of the processes of inheritance, primeval germs of existence, where they are and what they are and how they are transmitted through any given species for ages and ages. It also, if it doesn't tell you explicitly, it certainly implies that any changes in the forms that are going to be used by nature do not come about in the processes of so-called slow evolution, adjustment to environment, such as Darwin says. They come as a result of internal stimuli, internal forces which change the germplasm. These are the things that give, say, DNA its instructions, which DNA hands on to the mechanisms of inheritance. So we are looking at a really comprehensive science when we're looking at theosophy. And then in the last talk, lecture number four, we talked about reincarnation. And we showed how in man's being he reflected the three streams of evolution that Adam talked about, the monadic, the intellectual or psychic, and the physical. We saw that the monad, via its vehicles, I don't know whether I dare call him, yes, Buddhi is a vehicle of Atma, via its vehicles of Buddhi and Manas, accumulates experience of the lower karmic monastic principles, themselves become conditioned by life, and that experience is all stored in the auric envelope. I dismissed yesterday, laughingly, a question which Ianthe asked at the beginning of her game. I didn't know how seriously she wanted us to play this game. And she said, something to the effect, how is it that we don't remember our past lives? And I just glibly said, well, the brain's extinct and how can it remember when it isn't there? Well, the process is not anything like as simple as that. The memory of everything or anything is stored in the astral light, but so to speak, and this is a very defective expression, part of that as it relates to the human being is, so to speak, encapsulated in the auric egg. And it's to that certain areas of the brain in the matter of memory seem to have an intimate connection while we're alive. Our own private experience is immediately available to us through this memory aspect of the brain. This is the thing that brings through from the dream state, or even when we're asleep, any egoic experience to our brains on waking, and we feel either to have had a dream or a vision or something like that. When the brain begins to wake up, that then affects consciousness, and we have this dream or feeling of having had some experience. Well, now there seems to, whereas the astral light is the general memory, it seems that it is, so to speak, compartmentalized as far as we are concerned when we're operating at our level. Now it seems also that between the death states, with the death of the brain, that little bit of compartmentalism disappears at our level of conscious operating. It is still there and still available to us when we can operate at higher levels of being. But when a brain dies, then this mechanism is suspended for the time being from operation, so we don't have that memory. Now even all that is a deficient explanation, but it's a bit of an amplification on what happened last night. The reincarnation then. Three streams. There is a continuity by means of the ego assimilating the spiritual content of lives. Nothing else can ever reach that level of being. Then there's the continuity at the psychic or karma manasic level of being by way of the skandhas which affect that area of our being. And then there is the transmission of physical characteristics and tendencies by way of the life atoms, the pranic life atoms, the linga sharira, affecting, in their turn, the physical body. So there you have three kinds of, three levels of the transmission of cause as a result of a person having lived to become effect as far as the next person is concerned. And then in lecture 5, the talk, I tried to relate all this sort of technical knowledge to man as a being now responsible for his own progress in the world, both individually and collectively. We have now the understanding as given us by theosophy. We understand the process. We understand we are part of the process. No man can become isolated or opt out. No way. We're in it. We're in it. And we are the only people to advance humanity. We being the whole of humanity, of course. There's no other way. Now, when we begin to realize this, we have then a real struggle inside us, because this realization usually conflicts enormously with our
private predilections. What's another word for predilections?
Choices, preferences.
Yeah. We want to go on living our lives as we have always lived them. We've set up life habits. We have set up likes and dislikes. We have established relationships. We've established habitual modes of living, eating and enjoying ourselves and spending our time and watching the television and doing whatever else we come to like. Now, all this activity, of course, is educational. But if we want to be partners, so to speak, in the development of the race, something much more conscious than that has to go on inside us. And these I summarized very quickly in the matter of our living rightly with regard to the body, bringing our emotions and so on under control, and then our minds, so that we could live the more effectively from within outwards. We were establishing really an inner point of the initiation of action. We're becoming our own masters. Now, the only way that humanity as a whole will be affected is first by the changes that take place in the individuals, and then, as we said, and this is very important, but in this matter of example. And this requires a great sacrifice, because to a large extent we are separating ourselves out from the ordinary run of humanity, wherein we've been all boys and girls together, and nobody quite likes to divorce themselves from that. But there comes a time, if we would push ahead of the general advancement and become, so to speak, leaders, it's necessary, when we've established ourselves properly, to remove ourselves from the ordinary run of affairs, because they are total distractions. They would prevent, they do prevent, our internal progress. Well, and then I, as I said, went full circle and started to talk about the Aquarian conspiracy. This matter of the networks around the globe of people who were beginning to break out of the habitual run-of-the-mill way of thinking, the accepting of old ideas, the accustomed ones to which convention lends tremendous authority. A man again has to be a bit courageous to break away from the ordinary run of thought. I don't know whether this is a proper tale to tell here, but when I was a boy I was very attached to God. I was a very devout young man, I really was, and spent a lot of time in church and thinking about him and praying to him and all the rest of it. And at this time I was an apprentice in the works, and it so happened that I made friends with a Brahmin engineer from India, and quite contrary from what you might think, this man started me thinking properly. He asked all the awkward questions, and they were very awkward. And because I was so passionate about this thing, I began to be anxious. Surely this thing by which I've laid so much store up to now can't be wrong. And look at the thousands and tens of thousands, if not millions of people in whose company I am. They can't all be wrong. And look at the revered teachers that we have. At this time we had a very fine canon of the church. And I remember this business came to a crisis one night, and my parents were out, and I went to the telephone and I got on the thing, picked it up like this and dialed the vicarage, and the canon answered it, and I said, can I come and see you? So he said, good gracious, is it urgent? I said, yes. So when he said, I can give you 10 minutes before dinner. So I ran all the way down there. It was a good half mile. And started to ask this poor old man these questions. Well, of course he couldn't answer them. And the answers kept coming, well, you must have faith, my son. And I can remember them sitting there and challenging God. I said, look, God, if you're up there, I want to have some manifestation of your power. You can do what you like, but I want to know whether or not you're there, and I mean it. And I said, I am not afraid. You who know everything must know that I want the truth, and I am sincere in this, and surely you can't deny me something. So I didn't know what the old man was saying, so I sat back and waited for the thunderbolt or for the floor to open, and it didn't. And then my heart began to beat. I thought, crikey, what have I done? And then, because God didn't do anything, I thought, said, I'll give you 5 seconds in which to come. Is it true? The young man in his teens to have made that decision was something. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't know what to expect. I had expected that, you know, my world had come to an end because this had meant everything to me. Well, I had hardly got out of this house and thanked the canon very much for his attention. Then I began to feel so happy it wasn't true. My feet were as if they had wings. They didn't touch the ground all the way home. I was in a transport of joy. And that was the beginning of my quest for theosophy. Anyway, that's a little bit by the way. But it shows that you need some courage in these things. And periodically through your life, you're confronted with decisions of this magnitude. And you have not to fail. You have to go through with it.
Go on with the other bit about Scotland. John Coates.
Come on.
Where you met him.
Remind me.
How you came into
yeah.
Sexual theosophical.
You know, how you met John and how he sort of brought you into theosophy. You know, you told us how you met John Coates.
That was in the war.
About some years
was
after.
Was there a story about that? I've forgotten.
Yeah, it was originally a story.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's so all these tales are so long. Yes. Yes. Well, let me finish this first, and we come back to that. One or two things. Yes, one of the things I wanted to make, you see, it may be that a conference of this kind, it gives ideas only, but doesn't really change our lives to the intense extent that is necessary for action to follow as far as our individual lives are concerned, our doing something about it. Now, I have uttered the words, and you will all agree with me as a matter of reason, that we have some responsibility for the progress of the race. We have a responsibility. We know when we are sane what we are doing. But are we going to do anything about it? Now, we all feel, in this respect, to be helpless. But I think I have shown that if we really mean this thing, we are not helpless, because in the instant we decide to do something about it, a transformation process begins to take place. It may take years to come to fruition, but we've sown a seed. And that transformation process is the beginning of a change in us. such that we become more effective human beings in the circle in which we are. Something stamps us as being possessed of something, maybe that is a poor expression to use, the others haven't got, but there is something. And then, as I say, we are more effective. That is, we affect more people. Marilyn Ferguson uses the instance of Gandhi, a man who never tried to use force. He was a very strong character, and he inspired strength in all those people he touched, such that they were willing to make sacrifice and accept the disciplines of the state of conditions of life that he felt were necessary. Now, all those people, insofar as they followed Gandhi, added strength to his movement, such that in the end, without fighting, he removed the British from India, which probably could have meant bloody war for years. But there was not a shot fired in that cause. There was lots of rioting afterwards as a result of it. But notice the power of that man's influence. Well, those were the things I wanted to say, and hope I managed to say in the course of my talks. Now, I just wanted some comeback from you in the way of questions or anything. I haven't given you much time. Yes, good now.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for this review. And it's very inspiring to listen to a man like you who have worked so hard and assimilated it, and it come to a point of study where there is a kind of identity between the one who studies and the grand subject. And this is what I often miss among us in the society. We tend to one thing, we are one with the universe, and there is one knowledge which is a synthesis of the inner and the outer.
Yes. You know, I think there is, as HBB says, this is a kind of the intense study of a book like The Secret Doctrine puts mind into totally different avenues of thought. You haven't had those, they're not habitual. You've got to create a new sphere of thinking. Now, my look at this thing, and Adam may bear this out too, because I'm certain he's had the same experiences, is that every time you get one of these implosions, so to speak, something that goes off in your brain, and you suddenly see the light, your whole being is modified. The thing has become vivified. There is a connection then made between what up to that time had been an idea and the living elements within yourself. That's what is happening. So the thing is a process of change. Now, I may perhaps have given the idea that the study is a dreary business that has to go on for years and years and years before anything happens. But in some way that isn't quite so. First of all, I've mentioned the joy. Adam says he does it because he wants to, he's impelled to, and so was I, incidentally. When once you've started, there's no stopping. So there is already an inner spark. And then, in my life, as I indicated by this confrontation of God and so many other times, I have had this great feeling of enlightenment, of